Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
The federal law, credited with dramatically increasing athletic opportunities for girls and women, is the subject of a new book titled Getting in the Game, Title IX and the Women's Sports Revolution. The author, Deborah Brake, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, presents evidence for continued optimism regarding the aims of those who crafted the law, even as she acknowledges various challenges still to be overcome. When we spoke this week, I began the conversation by asking Professor Brake to review the purpose of Title IX.
Title IX is a pretty general statement that no person shall be discriminated against on the basis of sex in any education program or activity receiving federal funds. It's a very open-ended statement that leaves a lot of room for interpretation. And as it applies to sports, we're in particularly complicated water because unlike most areas where you have discrimination law, you have sex-separate programs in sports. And that in itself, I think, has allowed for Title IX to develop in a very creative way. Because we've got sex-separate programs, the law was able to craft some more creative standards than you see in other areas of discrimination law. And I think that has enabled the law to be particularly results-oriented and successful in opening up opportunities to women in this area.
You have written that you want your book, quote, to contribute to a greater understanding of Title IX. How has the law been misunderstood?
Well, in so many ways, it's hard to find someone who doesn't know about Title IX and who doesn't have an opinion about Title IX. But that's not to say that everyone, frankly, knows what they're talking about. In fact, you'll even see Title IX referred to in the news media, you know, incorrectly as the law that requires equal funding between men's and women's sports. Well, it doesn't require equal funding. Or by critics, you know, the law that is responsible for cutting men. And there's a wealth of information out there showing that it's not responsible for cutting men. So I wrote this book largely to demystify Title IX, to kind of match the level of information with the already level of interest and familiarity with it, and to demystify this great law.
According to a National Women's Law Center study, one measure of the impact of Title IX has been a tenfold increase in participation in varsity sports by girls at the high school level. But you found that currently the growth in girls and women's sports in high school and college is not keeping up with the growth in boys and men's sports. Does your finding argue against the efficacy of Title IX?
No, not in any way. In fact, I'd say that the big message of this book is that there really has been a revolution that Title IX prompted. And to put it in perspective, if you think about 1971, the year before the law was enacted, only one in every 27 high school girls participated in sports. One in 27, so it's very unusual. Today, that number is almost one in every two. 50% of high school girls at least one year in high school will play varsity sports. That's extraordinary. I mean, that's really a change to the very nature of girlhood and adolescence. But I do point out in the book that the increases in girls and women's participation has basically remained flat over the last 8 or so years. And we're not there yet. We still have a long way to go to get true equality with Title IX, but the changes so far have been tremendous.
You posit that Title IX has resulted in the development of, quote, a deeper appreciation for female athletes in the U.S. But attendance at WNBA games has been flat for years. Women's pro soccer has been a difficult sell. Outside of Connecticut and Tennessee, women's college basketball games don't draw nearly as many fans or get nearly as much TV coverage as the men's games. Where do you find this deeper appreciation?
It is true that in professional sports, you may not see the kind of support for women's sports that we would like at this point. But at the educational level, where sports are in the schools, you really have seen a tremendous movement in the popularity of women's sports. And in terms of the lives of girls and girl culture, it is cool to be a female athlete today. And that was not the case pre-Title IX. The cool girls used to be the cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. And today, athletics is really a path to a social status for girls.
A standard argument for those opposing and trying to dismantle Title IX has been that more athletic opportunities for girls and women has meant fewer for boys and men, specifically boys and men who wrestle. Is there any statistical basis for that complaint?
There is some truth that some wrestling teams have dropped, but there's tremendous evidence that Title IX is not the culprit for that. In fact, if you look at men's sports opportunities overall, there's a 2007 GAO U.S. government report that shows that these have grown in the post-Title IX era. Men's athletic participation has not taken a hit since Title IX. It has expanded, and women's has expanded also. What you do see is some sport-specific shifting in both men's and women's programs. And yes, wrestling is one of the sports on the decline. So, by the way, is women's gymnastics. But these sport-specific changes are really driven by institutional considerations like liability, student interest, injuries, and frankly, a shift of resources into other sports programs. So I do think Title IX is often scapegoated for something that is not really that it's not really responsible for.
One of the themes of your book seems to me to be that many self-identifying feminists have been insufficiently appreciative of the importance of sports for girls and for women. What accounts for that attitude?
I think a couple of things. I mean, for one thing, a lot of the feminist movement has been about kind of explaining away the differences in bodies, you know, sort of the approach of treat us like men, ignore pregnancy in the workplace or treat it like other kinds of physical issues, you know, focus on the life of the mind, workplace opportunities, and sort of, you know, whenever women's bodies come up in feminism, it's usually not a good thing, you know, to get away from that. But I think there's also been some ambivalence about sports in particular as such a male-dominated institution that, you know, sometimes I think feminism has made the mistake of trivializing sports or, you know, painting sports with one brush as, you know, a misogynistic institution, kind of like war, that we should, you know, not legitimate. And certainly that is not by any means true for all feminists, but I think the movement as a whole has neglected sport.
A recent study by Betsy Stevenson called Title IX and the Evolution of High School Sports purports to demonstrate statistically how Title IX has benefited girls and women beyond their academic experience. How did she do that?
She did a very innovative thing, a creative thing. She looked at the variation among states in female sports participation growth between 1971 and 1978. 1971, of course, the year before Title IX was enacted, and then 1978, a period of time when, in reaction to the law, at the high school level, a lot of sports were added for girls, when essentially they practically didn't exist in 1971. And because boys' sports participation varied by state, the increase for girls varied by state. And what she did was to look at the fluctuations in the increase, that is, those states where there was a huge number added compared to those states where there was a smaller number added. And she found that in those states where there was a larger number added, there was also a boost in women's participation in the workforce once that cohort grew up, and there was a boost in picking traditionally male jobs, even a boost in wages, although that was a bit more tenuous. Mm-hmm. But she did it in a way that tried to control for other kinds of differences in states that might influence these things. And I'm not an economist, but when I read the study, I thought, and I can't pretend to follow every one of her mathematical equations, but it looked quite rigorous and carefully done as a way of finally getting at the question of causation. You know, are sports really causing these gains?
You mention wanting to see more equalities. Where does progress still need to be made? Where are the inequalities that still need to be addressed?
Well, we still don't have parity in terms of the numbers of athletic opportunities available to men and women at the high school and college level. And we've seen female participation rates hover at around the 40% mark in the past 5 to 8 years. And to really have equality, we need to push that up to match female enrollment. We've also got to do better in terms of the treatment of female athletes. You still see, you know, a lot of instances of problems with facilities. For example, the boys' baseball stadium having the state-of-the-art everything, concession stand, lights for night games, a dugout, great locker rooms. And then the softball field, for example, will be at an off-site facility. It's often borrowed from a private community league. It doesn't have lights. You can't play at night. It's not maintained by the school. That kind of thing still goes on far too often. You see scheduling inequalities with girls' games being put in the afternoon where you can't get people from the community to leave work and come see them. And you see the boys' games getting the primetime slots. And all that really does create a cycle of suppressing interest in girls' sports. And if we're really going to complete the revolution, we've got to get at those kinds of inequalities.
When you talk about equality, I'm wondering if, having done all the research that you had to do for this book, you came away with a personal sense of whether it's a good idea to integrate boys and girls, specifically at the high school, perhaps at the college level, in terms of their playing the same sport together.
You know, that was actually one of the toughest questions that I did take on in the book. And I really do see that as a true dilemma. That is, there is no easy answer to it because both choices have a downside. If you go the integrated route where you say we're just going to have one team, let the best athlete play, you really do risk backtracking in terms of the mass numbers of girls and women playing sports at the varsity level. You know, you frankly risk tokenism, that yes, there'll be some fantastic female athletes who can compete at the very highest level against boys, but you're not going to see the same level of participation changing lives in girls and women's lives. So there's a downside to that. There's also a downside to the separate model. You risk, I think, you know, what some would say we have now, a second-class status for girls' sports. You risk kind of stigmatizing girls as having to have their own team because they can't compete with boys. And I think there's a downside to either choice. Where I ultimately come down is to think that Title IX makes the right judgment call in allowing sex-separate teams as the default because it really is prioritizing concrete opportunities for the largest number of girls and women over whatever ideological message that separation sends, which we could argue about. So I do argue in the book that we should expand in some instances the integration rights, that is, the right to play on a different sex team. But in the end, I think that the baseline is the right one for now in prioritizing mass participation of girls and women with their own teams.
You point out in your book that football and men's basketball still eat up most of the athletic budgets at universities and colleges across the country, particularly Division I. Title IX became the law nearly 40 years ago. Is the ongoing emphasis on football and men's basketball evidence that the legislation really hasn't done what it was designed to do in terms of resource allocation?
Well, it has been very hard to chip away at the spending inequality that you see, especially at the college level, where football, big-time football and men's basketball budgets are just, you know, crazy when you look at them. And they continue to get crazier. You see the arms race, you know, seemingly unhampered by the economic straits that you see higher education in today. So, you know, in some respects, yes, I think it is disappointing that Title IX was not able to rein that in. I'm not surprised that that's happened because there was a judgment made to not go for funding equality. I mean, it's clear in the Title IX regulations that a funding disparity alone does not violate Title IX. You have to do a much more complicated analysis that's qualitative of looking at what that money buys. And that makes it a lot harder to prove a Title IX violation just from spending inequality. You know, but the bottom line is that it's not just Title IX that's failed to do that. It's all of the other pressures, too, and all of the other criticisms of the big business model of sports. None of that has really sunk in. And frankly, I'm not sure what it's going to take to rein in, you know, multi-million-dollar coaching, football coaching contracts for colleges where, you know, they're paid several times more than the university president. I'm not sure how you get at that. But Title IX has not been able to crack that nut either.
people who celebrate the benefits of sports for girls and women will likely continue to support the enforcement of Title IX, perhaps its expansion, and people who blame the law for the elimination of specific men's sports, such as wrestling and gymnastics, will likely continue to rail against Title IX. What is the impact of the law likely to be going forward?
As I see it, the big story of the past 10 years has been how Title IX has resisted the backlash. I mean, we really went through a period during 8 years of the Bush administration where a lot of people thought Title IX was on the chopping block. There was a lot of, you know, vocal criticism of the law, blaming it as a quota. There were a number of efforts made to turn back the clock on Title IX. And amazingly, really, when you look at it in hindsight, none of that came to fruition. And the closest the thing that we saw was a 2005 guidance by the Office for Civil Rights that did take a step toward weakening Title IX compliance. And that was just rescinded a couple of months ago in the Obama administration. So what really strikes me about the story is that Title IX has remained remarkably popular. There's a 2007 poll that I cite in the book that shows that over 80% of respondents said they strongly favor Title IX. You saw no less a conservative than Sarah Palin in the last presidential election claim to be a supporter of Title IX. She called herself a product of Title IX because of her high school basketball experience. And so, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's the third rail of politics, but I do think we've seen the kind of cultural change that's made it very hard to turn back Title IX. There are too many parents, including fathers, invested in their daughters' sports opportunities to see Title IX turned back without a great deal of resistance.
Deborah Brake, professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, is the author of Getting in the Game, Title IX and the Women's Sports Revolution. It's published by New York University Press, and she joined me from WQED in Pittsburgh. Professor Brake, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
My conversation with Deborah Brake, author of Getting Into the Game, will be featured on this week's program. We'll also have the story of my day at the Suffolk Downs racetrack in the company of a dozen big and not so big spenders from a retirement community near Boston. We'll visit with the defending Super Bowl champs, the New Orleans Saints, who delighted their New England fans by practicing right alongside the Patriots this week. With the assistance of Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com, I will acknowledge that the NFL season is about to begin, and we'll also have a story about the Cincinnati Reds. Prognosticators are scratching their heads about how well the Reds are doing. We'll see if we can figure out how Cincinnati has been prevailing, except over the Cardinals this week. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio.